Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
All right, folks! Imagine you are here for building better world building, stealing from history, where we basically talk about all the ways that we can learn from all the lovely lessons we had in our childhood and or adult education and use to make some awesome campaign settings. Before we get going with that, though, we should probably get some introductions. Hi, I'm John Compton. I'm the Organized Play lead developer, and,
Hi, John.
I see it's that sort of meeting, then. Okay. And I make settings.
And you've been...
Oh, yeah.
I am Amanda Hammond-Hoots. I'm the development coordinator for Paizo as of 6 days ago.
Woo!
And I help run the development team at Paizo.
Hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm part of the development team at Paizo. I run the Adventure Path line, and I've been writing for Paizo for 7 years?
Woo!
Yeah. I'm Amber Scott. I'm the guest of honor.
Yeah.
I've been writing for Paizo for a long time. Probably about 14 years now. I think my first big kind of article in Dragon magazine back in the day was in 2003, and
Watsi publishes Dragon magazine.
They do now, but back in the day, they were published by Paizo, and so that's how I got my start. And I did freelancing article writing for them for a few years, and then I got into book writing, and that eventually led me to being the contributor I am today. And Iron Fang Invasion just came out; it's my fourth AP, and I have another one coming up in a few. I don't know, this year, I think. And then another one next year.
We haven't announced that one yet.
Yeah. So. Some secret ones coming up. So it's pretty exciting.
Come to the Adventure Path panel. We'll tell you everything.
Everybody.
Except then.
The lights go out.
Come on.
So as far as just covering some basics, I mean, a lot of settings already draw from history. Like, if you take a look at Galarian, it's already a mishmash of other real-world cultures. And perhaps one of the things, maybe, do we want to start talking about how to, or like, where's the line in terms of borrowing, or do you want to talk about inspirations first?
I think we should talk about inspirations first and then talk about how you should and shouldn't use it.
That sounds fantastic. Thoughts?
All right. Well, history is really screwed up and fun. In fact, it's a lot more screwed up than anything you could think of on your own, or I. More screwed up than anything I could think of. I don't know how screwed up any of you are.
I'm not saying something.
But history contains events that if they were in a fictional, if they were in a novel or a film, you'd say that makes no sense. Why would anyone do that? But people do that. So it ends up being a really innovative source for historical characters, events, fashions, just about anything you can think of, if you hit a brick wall creatively. I studied anthropology. I know John studied anthropology. Amber, did you study anthropology too?
I took an anthropology class once.
So we are...
As an elective.
Elective.
So we got an anthropologist over here.
Definitely.
But yeah, they've ended up being huge inspirations to a lot of the things I write, if only to give me a jumping off point to start writing.
And I think that's one of the things in particular that you mentioned brings up an excellent point, because we can talk about borrowing from history from a strictly timeline perspective, mm-hmm. or an events perspective, but you mentioned even fashion. Like, the idea of taking visuals from history can be really great. So I know Crystal, among many of my other colleagues, have taken a look at different outfits across the world when we're looking for art inspiration for, okay, what do we want this group to look like? For me, I did some various archaeological work, and I have a lot of pictures from sites that I visited, and I say, oh, wow, this intersection is interesting, or, oh, wow, these guys all do corbelled arches, because that's how architecture works in this area. So you can start to just take images and use that as a jumping off point rather than saying, well, I do know that I want to make sure that somebody is defenestrated in my timeline.
What does that window look like?
And what does that window look like?
Are these windows big enough to shove someone through, or are we going to have to chop them up first?
How was the glass made then? Was it like really thick, or is this like, you know?
Single pane only, you know?
Exactly.
We don't know how much they're going to weigh, right?
I love the idea, though, that there's a double defenestration. they tried to shove the person out one time and realized it wouldn't work.
Turn them sideways.
I should have chosen the guillotine.
Not invented yet.
Come on. And that's a really good point, is that I think a lot of people just sort of academically tend to look at history as just sort of a series of dates and events and things that, you know, are connected tangentially and are a little bit dry, but when you look at history as a story, and when you look at the players in history as characters, and when you look at the background, you know, as sort of seeding into the events, then it sort of does become much more inspirational, much more rich from a world-building perspective. So you can look at history and how different events happened and how things unfolded, how wars went, how rebellions started, and you can plug those into your own campaign setting, and it feels more realistic because it is based on something that's actually real.
Mm-hmm. Like, if you, let's say you want to write a 9-part novel series, epic fantasy, and you want it to be about struggles, and war, and just family squabbling in some sort of throne-oriented game, well, you might look at other times there have been big wars of secession in history, and then you might steal a scene where everybody goes to a big wedding dinner and everybody gets murdered. Pretty much
hyper
for that.
Just off the top of your head.
Sounds familiar.
And another thing that you can do with history is when you're looking at the different events that take place or even how those boundaries
form. We'll do questions at the end.
Yeah. Or at least at some point. is you can look at how these boundaries or how these political developments happened and say, okay, because this has happened in history already, there's a basis within sort of our historical understanding, whether it's within your group, whether it's within your readership, that that's a plausible thing. So if you have an empire that spans a bajillion square miles, then you start to look at some of the real-world empires and how did they maintain communication?
Really good roads.
And maybe at that point you start saying, well, damn it, my empire needs really good roads.
And that's why you play Rome in Civilization.
But doing that, or looking at why do I see the Roman Empire has this weird squiggly line around certain bits of its borders? Oh, haha, rivers, or mountains, or
Gauls.
One of the lesser known geographic features. Both Parthian horse archers. This is terrible for farming. But if you start with that, geography. Hey.
Yeah, I think one aspect of using history to influence my games is that I always remember that history is really, really big, but it's also really, really small. Tiny details from history can be just as interesting as, you know, wars and how, you know, volcanoes exploding and things like that. Pompeii is a good example, as clearly it's something we remember as a giant volcano erupted, everybody died, it was tragic, and it was monumental. But there are also, like, so many little details that were preserved in the site. I don't know if anyone here has read the graffiti that they found in Pompeii that was preserved. They're amazing. Like, some of it is just so-and-so was here. Some of it was really vulgar. Some of it was kind of amazing. And it really, like, added a humanity. You should Google. I can't do it justice trying to say it off the top of my head. So if you look for Pompeii graffiti, that's a great...
Crystal pulls on her eye?
Yeah. We have to find the one about the... Sorry, ladies. That was the best one. There's one that always stuck with me, though. That was... it was two guys, and if you can find it, where they're like, hey, we were two guys, we're best friends, and we were here. And you know that they never made it out. And I'm like, man, I still think about that sometimes, that they were bros. They were having a great time in Pompeii, and then
this
they...
is just a bunch of drawings of penises.
It really is. Yeah. And that can be a really meaningful moment that can spark an adventure idea, character ideas. Did you find it?
I did. I screwed the barmaid.
Oh, yeah.
Lesbianus, you defecate and you write hello, everyone.
Yes. Find the dudes that I liked.
But, yeah, I mean, this is useful for... I mean, if you're writing, it's really useful for inspiration or to help you flesh out the details in your world or what kind of small events your characters might come across while they're on their way to slay a dragon or topple an evil emperor or things like that. And honestly, if you're just a GM at home, there are so many weird little twists and turns you can find in history just... I mean, I find a lot of inspiration for adventures and world building just listening to a couple of history podcasts in my spare time. Mm-hmm.
This is the one. We two dear men, friends forever, were here. If you want to know our names, they are Gaius and Alice.
Aww.
I don't know why. I'm just like friends forever. I mean, we're here. But really,
the buds. Yeah.
And then I do have to read this one, and there's no children here, right?
We are recording, but...
Okay, this one says, "Weep, you girls. My penis has given you up. Now it penetrates men's behinds. Goodbye, wondrous femininity."
and so it's little things like this. That, I mean,
you know, if that's not a bard, I don't know.
is that why they eat Elven bards? Secret?
let's just say it's got a lot to do. No.
those small moments in history I find very inspirational because it shows how people were different, but also how a lot has remained unchanged. Mm-hmm. And that can make a game feel very realistic to the players.
And for setting, whether it's just during play or whether you're creating your own setting, those small details act as a humanizing element for the setting. They remind the players that these aren't just 5-foot squares that they're moving through, that there is meaning, and that people get upset over the damnedest things. campaign that I was in college, we were in a port, and we were like, we want to buy local food. And somebody's like, well, we sell fish biscuits, at which point somebody said, fish biscuits? No! Fish and rice! And we realized that we were in the middle of some sort of terrible, like, street food...
I like this.
Gang war. So it's those moments that you realize, oh, right, this is somebody's livelihood. We can't just... This is not just a bag of 4 hit points that we can push into the river because we're adventurers.
I mean, we can, but now we feel bad about
it. They'll find
politics
down there.
Exactly. Depends, but these are people with hopes and aspirations, and they can be reflected through many different facets of the world.
All right. So should we talk about when and when it is not appropriate to steal?
We can start to work into that. Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. In general, finding inspiration, awesome. Lifting names and places and direct events?
A is for appropriation.
Are you talking about for people's like home games or publishable materials?
Yeah,
or is there a difference?
It's less of an issue for home games, mm-hmm. just because, I mean, home GMs are a lot more tried for time. They don't have a whole team of editors who will come along behind you and say, John, this is really racist. And I say this because John is probably the least racist person in Paizo.
You would.
It's because I'm Scottish, isn't it?
Fish biscuits.
Whoa, that is hard.
No, oh, no.
That's not actually hard.
It's going to be a thing now, isn't it?
Fish biscuits. But yeah, as Crystal was saying, using this for inspiration is great, but keep in mind that whatever you are drawing upon not only is important to some number of people living today, but if you are lifting directly, in a way you're hindering your own creative expression. Because if I just make Roman Empire, but their skin is blue... there are ways that I can do far more than this. I can still take the idea of, oh, a potentially failing republic or squabbling republic and the rise of dictatorship. I can do some cool stories with that, and I've only started to pull some things from Rome. Or
we're talking about Rome, right?
take one or two concepts from one of these societies and use that as a starting point, and then spin it to fit whatever else it is you're doing within your setting.
Yeah, I think the more threads that you can pull from different sources and put together something that feels new and fresh and is cool and is interactive and is, you know, enticing to your players, that's going to be much more rewarding for them than just pulling something, like John said, just the Roman Empire whole cloth. Because unless you are, like, a collegiate scholar of the Roman Empire, you're not going to even really know all of the nuances of how that works. So it's better for you to sort of flesh that out on your end first. And also just keep in mind the way you're presenting things. You know, if you're taking another culture, you know, that's not yours and you're lifting a whole cloth and you're putting it into your game and you're portraying them really offensively, or you're making these connections, you know, that are just really, you know, offensive and marginalizing to people of that culture, then that's not a good idea. That's taking, that's appropriation, and it's making, you know, other people feel less than, and that's not what you want to do as the GM.
Yeah, not to mention it does you as a disservice, because it gets you used to thinking,
okay,
you and your that players, yeah, thinking that you're allowed to do this, thinking that it kind of stunts your thinking in regards to other people.
Yeah. And then you have somebody who enters the game who is from that culture and who sees, you know, that their livelihood, their lifestyle, whatever is being a joke, you know, is being made fun of, and, you know, they come out with a really negative opinion of you, and you've made the game, you've represented the game in a way that's off-putting to them, and, you know,
if you don't want to do that, you're awesome, the game's awesome.
Right.
Stay awesome.
Yeah. Everyone just wants to be awesome.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it comes down to basically looking at history in terms of inspiration and how people react in weird situations and what's within the realm of possibility for people. Like, oh lord. Like, one of the founding fathers of the United States was a genius inventor and one of the greatest scientific minds in the last 200 years and an eloquent poet. And he was also, like, just a pervy, drunken old lech. So these things aren't at all mutually exclusive, and it tells you that you can have a very complicated, nuanced character who isn't necessarily a perfectly good guy, isn't necessarily a bad guy, but just has a lot of nuance and disparate elements that, I mean, if you were just writing a character out of your head, you probably wouldn't think, yeah, he's like a genius, like, well, I wouldn't say Tony Stark, because Tony Stark, you immediately think Lothario drunkard, but what I'm saying is Tony Stark is specifically Ben Franklin.
Okay.
Anyway.
That's a crossover we never thought we'd see. Now it's here.
Really? Am I the only one who saw this?
Apparently.
You bring up a point that makes me think of another thing about history, which is that one reason why it's easy to misrepresent cultures and things that you haven't done a lot of work studying is because you have ideas about how they are, and you might think you know things that are not true. And this applies to all of history. We almost always, if you can think of a point in history and you ask a bunch of people, what was it like for women in Victorian times? They'd say, oh, it was terrible. They were all repressed and nobody was allowed to have sex and they couldn't have jobs. And
but Annie Oakley had a job and had lots of sex.
Then the more you read, the more you see that some of that stuff may be trends. Some of it may be outright not true.
Some of that might just be the stuff they were telling people.
Yeah. And you,
to try and get you to act a certain way.
And so I always feel like if you're really serious about using a historical something, place, time, person as an inspiration, it's really, really fun and interesting to do a little deeper research into it, because you'll find things that you weren't expecting. And we may think we know a lot about certain periods of time. And again, when you get into the details, it can be very inspirational. I recently read a book called Macy Dobbs, which is a mystery novel set in post-World War I. And she was a nurse, and now she's a lady detective. And it was actually really fun. One thing I found really interesting, where I actually went to like my friend and I was like, oh, I gotta use this in a game, was when you're a soldier and say you want to write to your sweetie who's a nurse in the war, during World War I, you could write a letter, and then it would go to the postmaster, and then it would get all bundled up, and it would go to like a central depot, and then the censors would read them over and like ink out anything you didn't want people to read. And for security, basically, was the idea. So if the letters were intercepted or something. And then they would go to like a distribution thing, and they would get put with different people who would ride out to different units and Love and Letters, and it took like weeks and weeks. Or if you, in this book in particular, her sweetie was a doctor, and he was very well respected, and he would just write letters and then give them to a guy who was driving to this other camp, who would give it to the guy who like did lunch deliveries, and then he would give it to the lady who was bringing new bandages there, and then it would get to you, and it wouldn't be censored because it never went through the central depot. And also, everyone along the way who had to deliver this letter would read it because they were really bored and it was wartime. And some people would make, like, add comments, like, that's totally not true, he was drunk that night, or something like that. Somebody got the letter, like, four people had added comments to it. And I'm like, that is amazing. Like, imagine the players getting hired by a distressed, you know, mother to recover her dead son's, like, correspondence from the war. And they're like, sure, we could do that, we're good people. And then when they go, they find out his letters had, like, important military secrets in it, and enemy spies are, like, trying to get it. And they're like, why are people trying to, like, kill us over these love letters? Like, what is the deal? Like, that would be such an interesting adventure. And just got it from a random, like, historical detail.
Yeah, Amber makes a really good point that, like, if you want to model something in your campaign setting or your story after something that's historical, it's important to do more than just read the Wikipedia entry for the thing. Like, seek out, if you can, primary sources. So pulling, you know, something that was written by, you know, a journalist during the time, or a diary of a person who lived during the time, or, you know, a lot of times you can find, you know, scholars that have, you know, written a lot of things that aren't necessarily in the history books you read when you were in high school or college, but are way more interesting. And a lot of times the stuff you read, you know, in your secondary or post-secondary education is a little sanitized. So you'll get more interesting details, and a fuller picture will emerge the more that you look into something that's beyond just reading the basic surface details.
Read the graffiti.
Always read the graffiti. We should name this panel that next year.
One possibility of another thing that we can sort of run through, since we're stealing from history to make awesome campaign settings, do we as the panelists have favorite time periods, places, or people that we have found particularly inspiring in that regard?
Oh, wow.
Amber, do you want to start off on this one? I feel like we keep starting at this side of the table.
Well, you know, I'm Canadian, and there is a lot of very unique Canadian history that's not well represented in the media, unless you're from Canada, and you have to watch, like, educational films in high school. So it's a really interesting part of history post colonialization, where there were, you know, the fur trade was starting to boom. There were British people and French people coming over from Europe and were trying to create, you know, what's the word, commodities empires. And were working with First Nations tribes and fighting with First Nations tribes, forming alliances. And, you know, the Canadian history of the colonial settlers from Europe and First Nations people does parallel the United States in some degrees, but not all of them. And I mean, you know, we had different tribes, it was a different time period with much different focus. We weren't fighting for independence, we were looking for resources and things like that. And so it's a very interesting, there was the whole, like, the habitants in what's now Quebec, who were, like, these master woodsmen who came from France and built, like, these amazing lodges and stuff as they were cutting down forests. And one of our great writers of Canada is Pierre Burton, who does historical nonfiction, but he researches it to, like, a degree that is insane, and then makes a really, really detailed, but almost like novel-y books that are just chock full of information that he's woven into a story form. So if you're ever looking into Canadian history, some stuff that maybe people haven't experienced before in your game, I would definitely start with Burton's books. The first book I read by him was Klondike, which is all about the Canadian Klondike, the Canadian aspects of the Klondike Gold Rush. And that book, like, chilled my bones. There's some stuff that happened during the Klondike Rush that was, like, really, really, really scary. And one story I'll never forget, and then I'll switch off, is a Mountie, so a Mounted Police officer, going through the pass. One of the passes, and it had just finished, like, a couple weeks of really bad snow and everything like that, and he found the frozen bodies of several gold seekers sitting around a campfire, or what was a campfire. They were frozen in place, and in the campfire was a cooking pot filled with frozen water, ice, and the prospector's boots. that they had been trying to boil for food before they succumbed.
Wow.
Like, that is something harrowing that could show up in the game sometime.
Now we know what to look out for. Well, it's pretty obvious. Just, I live here. I love the history of Seattle and the Pacific Northwest because it is so screwed up. It was settled very late during America's manifest destiny phase, where we had to conquer everything from sea to sea, and by the time we got out here, we had a very different mindset about what was proper to do and be in the wilderness, and the story of founding Seattle is the story of people who have never been outside in their lives trying to build log cabins and farm.
On a 35-degree slope.
Yes.
That's not playing at the
bottom. And if we're talking about our favorite historical stories and anecdotes that we pull from...
I feel like we should share them.
Yeah, that we like to use for inspiration. So... there was the Great Seattle Fire in 1893?
88?
Something like that. Late 1880s, early 1890s. Seattle was originally just a boom town. It was a big lumber boom, and then that waned, and then it was a big gold boom for the Klondike Gold Rush. We're bringing it back around.
And like we've been doing this for years.
Yeah. Almost like we know
what we're doing. I know.
So, you know, streets went every which way, and houses were just erected immediately out of whatever timber was available, which was, like, very sap-rich pine. And, you know, precarious wooden buildings that were just added onto whenever they had the chance. And in the middle of all this, there was a sawmill that had basically been the focus of the entire town during the lumber boom, and everything was built around. So when a giant boiling pot of glue overturned in that sawmill, it caught fire, and basically the dead center of town just caught flame and spread everywhere. And at the time, Seattle was mostly filled with, like, late teens, early 20s guys who were stocking up on everything they needed for the Klondike Gold Rush and then sailing north, so they didn't have a lot of connections to the town. What they did have was a lot of whiskey.
I see where this is going.
Oh my god. And so you've got a bunch of college-age men, drunk, deciding to fight a fire, and they decide, well, we don't have a fire department, but we're miners, we have dynamite.
We can blow up the fire.
So we'll create a fire break. But they don't know how to create a fire break, so it's a bunch of 20-year-old guys hucking dynamite into burning buildings, which just sends more burning material across the rest of town.
I think an important takeaway from Crystal's retelling here is that... In a game like Pathfinder, there are very few ways to monumentally fail. For example, it's like, oh, it takes only a move action to put on a garment. Bull! So it's like, okay, like the number of seconds I can spend fumbling and messing around is terrible. But more importantly, people do dumb stuff.
Oh my god.
Yes,
yeah, it's players... Players ruining your game is not unrealistic. Players have been ruining history.
and having the PCs go out on an adventure from their safe town, only to come back and find it in ruins, and it's like, what happened? Oh, you know, old Betsy the horse got antsy, kicked over the lantern, so...
Flickering that night.
We all got drunk in Stoneburntown. Now what happens?
This doesn't even go into the potholes that swallow horses.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, immense.
So, as a brief aside to Crystal's story, for those of you who live here who are going to be here for a little while, I highly recommend the Seattle Underground Tour.
Yeah.
It's so
it
fun.
Tells,
yes.
And if you can, do the After Dark version, because they will tell you a little more of the full story of early Seattle and how it was financed.
You'll learn all about a Seattle sewing machine.
You will learn all about the seamstresses who made Seattle run in the early days. So I like a lot of periods of history, and I have a journalism degree, and I was a journalist for 10 years before I became a full-time RPG developer. And so, you know, I sort of learned a lot about history through the lens of the way journalism worked and the reporting that happened. And one of my favorite periods that, you know, that we discussed a lot was the muckraking period. And so that was, it was mostly in the 20s, but it sort of got it started in the late 1800s. And the woman who started the movement was Nellie Bly. And she was a single woman who was working for newspapers. And at the time, it was a very, very difficult thing, as were most industries, for women. And she kept getting put on, you know, the style section and, you know, the fashion section. She wanted to write news. She wanted to write about the robber barons of the day and all of the different scandals that were happening that the people didn't know anything about because, you know, penny press period. There was no internet. So she ended up living in New York in a boarding house trying to get news assignments, trying to, you know, do the type of work that she wanted to do. And these boarding houses had very strict rules for how the women had to act, and they had bedtimes, and they had curfews, and there were no men that were allowed in there because they were all unmarried women, and it was indecent and all of that. And she broke one of the rules by coming home late after work one night, and she refused to go to bed when the headmistress was like, you have to go to bed, you have to turn the light out, these are the rules. And so she got angry, and there was this dispute between her and this headmistress, and she ended up getting reported as being hysterical, and had to go before a judge and pretended to have amnesia because she's trying to get out of this, and the judge declares her insane and decides that she is going to get put in this insane asylum. And Nellie Bly, instead of trying to escape it, goes, okay, this is my opportunity. So she experiences the insane asylum, which was terrible. If you know anything about that time period, all the things that they used to put the inmates through who, you know, were considered insane at the time, all of the shock therapy and all these terrible things. And she meticulously noted on this paper that she hid under her bed, all of these things that she happened to her. And then when she got out, she published it. She showed all of it, and she had all of the dates, and she had everything proven and corroborated, and she became the first muckraker. And this exposed the way asylums treated these inmates, some of whom were, you know, interred in there for no good reason whatsoever, other than some judge decided they were crazy. So I think that helps me as a game writer sort of understand, like, okay, what are the ways that you can turn, like, a really bad situation to something that, you know, can start a whole movement, something that can start a whole story. And so, like, setting up a backstory in which players have all of these chances to have agency and stuff and, you know, take control of their own situation is something that really helps me be inspired.
Can you give an example of some adventure, published adventure, where
that... Oh, gosh. We have lots of intrigue type of adventures through Paizo.
To an extent, like, what happened there inadvertently was sort of a Trojan horse style story, yeah, where it's like if the PCs want to sneak in somewhere, then they say, all right, we're going to pretend to be pirates, or we're going to take over the pirate ship so we can sail it past the guards and into the harbor and do whatever the heck we need to. So a lot of those stories pull upon the same themes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I think it's more of a general sort of undercurrent in a lot of our adventures.
But it also reinforces that not only are people stupid, as the Sea of Fire shows, but people can be terrible people.
And sometimes people can, you know, use sort of their own resources to sort of overcome these situations that they're put into and make it a really interesting, compelling narrative.
Maybe the Whirlwind Incursion, the first Wrath of the Righteous AP.
Oh, yeah.
You're caught in the middle of a terrible situation. You've got no choice. You wind up buried underground. Spoiler alert. It's the very first scene in the very first book. And by the time you free yourself, you now have like a much vaster understanding of exactly what's at stake, and you have kind of the resources that put you on a path to destroying the Abyssal Invasion. I wrote that one.
A lot of the ones that I pull on are much older. Like for the Maya, one of the lessons I take away from them and love pulling from them is that geology happens, climate happens, and that can affect your setting. It might be affecting like the current setting, but what's even more important is as you're developing your history, keeping in mind that not only have some of the states in your setting changed, but the climate may have changed in radical ways. The Maya settled, they didn't have, there aren't really many rivers that go through Guatemala, Honduras, and southern Mexico, but it's all limestone. So there are things called cenotes, which are underground caves, that if you just line them with a little bit of plaster, they collect water, and they make underground reservoirs for cheap. Mayans used these for several hundred years, made a great civilization, and then you know what? The weather changed. It didn't rain as much. Drought happened, they all left. So, it doesn't have to be invasion, it doesn't have to be, like, political overthrow. It can be something as simple as, well, the wind sure did used to blow east a lot more, and now it doesn't. Same sort of thing with the desertification of the Sahara Desert. If you look back about 5,000 to 10,000 years, you get all this great rock art that shows fields of grass, cows all over the place, dozens of types of like ungulates and other things that people were hunting through there. And you look at it now, and it's desert because climate changes. So being able to build that into the history of your world shows that it's not static, that it changes over time, and that makes it... It sort of reinforces to your players or your readers as well that they can have a hand in changing things over time as well. As far as people doing dumb stuff and dumb things happening to good people, I think it's Boston that had like a syrup flood.
Oh, the molasses
flood. Yeah.
Where it's like, oh yeah, we sure did have like 10,000 gallons of molasses because we sure are going to make alcohol with it and stuff like that, but... Oh, it sure did break out on a cold day, so it flooded from the warm building until it congealed and the viscosity all went to heck, and basically you had 100 people trapped in an eight foot deep gelatinous cube-like monstrosity of molasses as a bunch of them were burning in it. A bunch of people were just trapped in, like, were caught in worse than quicksand. It's terrible, but it's one of those things where you're like, oh my gosh, that can happen?
Yeah, the Seattle syrup flood was not nearly as horrific.
Yeah,
and maple syrup in Canada.
Or in terms of Seattle, and this is something that I incorporated into the Eliosos article for Iblados in Distant Shores, is the first flushing toilets in Seattle. Seattle has some pretty nasty tides.
Oh,
very when your sewers tide. Go into the sound, and that means that when the tide comes in, it reverse flushes. So you had people living like 80 feet up the hill, and they're like, well, I guess I'm going to take a crap now, and then suddenly, boom, they get blasted off the toilet. And so for Eliosos, it's a place where it has like these 20 to 30 foot tides every day, and so what they did is once those tides started, because it's supernatural, they said, you know what, we had sewers? Sealed. We are bricking these things off, because twice a day they explode. This is done. But you can use that, these as ways of thinking, like, okay, what are the ramifications of the geology and geography of the area, and how would people change their expected behavior?
It's like the most secure locks in town are all on people's toilets.
Yeah. And going back to appropriation, another thing that I love is the appropriation that other cultures have done in history. So why appropriate why should you appropriate and make yourself look like an uncreative schmuck when you could borrow from all the other cultures that have appropriated? Like the Romans. The Romans move in, they say, all right, you guys have some gods, don't you? Oh, that's interesting. That one's called Bob. Let's see, well, little did you know, Bob is really Jove. He's been that the whole time, so really, Bob is part of our big divine pantheon family, so really we're all part of the same family, so why don't you pay taxes?
That's some nice civil engineering you got there.
It'd be a shame if some foreign invaders came in and built an aqueduct over it, and raised your standard of living. So,
what have the Romans ever done for us? Thank you.
So, I'm
recovering.
But the Greeks were also delightful in terms of what they did and did not share with each other, because you have this immense city-state period where you have somewhere around like 250 different city-states, each of which has its own squabble across the Mediterranean of, I hate this person, or I'm okay with this one, because technically our settlers came from there. Or this one makes
This one does fish biscuits. That is madness. And stuff as little as that. And even though they have like, it's like a, you know, humans and chimp DNA sort of moments where it's like, you're 96% the same. What's wrong with you? You can still develop this great sort of tension where it's okay. If you can do this mass say thing where it's like we can travel to all these places that have these things in common, but these pieces of history make it so that because 400 years ago, what's his face cut off the ear, what's her face, then they're still angry at each other. Good fun.
Is that a Worm Jenkins ear reference?
I guess it is. Yeah. Never gotten over it.
Questions are about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Can I say something real fast before we do questions?
Is that a question?
Sure.
Can I ask another 2 questions?
Okay.
So I wanted to give a quick shout out to a friend of mine up in Canada. Her name's Krista Ball. And she writes reference books for fantasy writers based on research she's done. And the first one is incredibly amazing, and it's called What Kings Ate and Wizards Drank. And I'm not sure if you can get it through Amazon, but I mean, if you search it, you can find it. And she actually went through and researched medieval cookbooks for like a year. And she did a play-by-play book on how medieval Western Europe, mostly people, ate and drank. And she tried to replicate recipes in her own kitchen, and she wrote the book specifically for fantasy writers. For example, she's like, hey, have you ever noticed how everyone eats a venison stew in books? Let's go through what it would actually take for you to kill a deer on your way to the capital and hang it and bleed it and then dry out the carcass and then stew the meat. You'd basically be there for a week. Like, that is not realistic. This is what you would actually trap.
It's hard pack, isn't it?
Cheese. She talks about everyone has wheels of cheese or like a, you know, a pocket with a handkerchief of cheese wrapped in it. She went through all the steps it takes to make cottage cheese, or what we call cottage cheese, soft cheese curds, versus like a hard wheel of cheese. She's like, if you were a peasant and an adventurer was like, hey, can I have a wheel of hard cheese? You would fight them to the death. That was like 6 months of your life right there. You would hide the cheese under your bed, and you would give them like a weird soggy piece of canvas full of like cheese curds and be like, it's fascinating. So I would definitely recommend that as a great reference book. And her second one was called Harlots, Hustlers, and something. And it's basically an examination of the Victorian steampunk era of what really happened. And then this is what you can use for your own inspiration. Things like, I didn't know on your way to work in Victorian England, you could stop by a kiosk and grab a cup of coffee on your way there from a coffee vendor. There was like Victorian Starbucks. You had to use the same cup as everyone before you. They just gave it to you, you drank it. Then the next person came in line and could scoop up more coffee. But hey, it's coffee. So yeah, that's Krista Ball. And definitely some great books.
Nice.
One sandal question, Colin. Got it. Yeah, you.
I was wondering how much emphasis you would put on original source work versus later interpretation or scholarship of that original source work.
My first response would be, it depends on how closely you're planning on borrowing from it in the first place. Like, if you're only looking to grab a little nugget of, or seed of an idea from it, whatever inspires you. But if you're trying to do something more involved in that, then the more confirmed the scholarship, the better.
Yeah, primary sources are almost always the best, but primary sources are often difficult to get and often, not in modern English.
Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, I'm taking it first. So I'm not sure that I got this straight, but I'm pretty sure that you are implying that Seattle is just Sandpoint.
Actually, common misconception. Sandpoint is James Jacobs' hometown in Northern California.
Okay. It seems that there's a lot of goblins in Seattle.
No, Seattle has kobolds.
Okay. We are a kobold city.
No more fish biscuits.
Fish biscuits.
Fish biscuits.
Point Arena, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So is this a fish biscuit town or a non-fish biscuit?
I cannot even believe you have to ask.
I'm working in Tacoma. I don't know any better.
That's fish rice town. All right. Yes.
I'm back.
What are your views on naming characters with allusions to history that aren't too obvious? Like, maybe name a character who's going to get trapped and then forced to go against their own family with the last name of Donner.
I think once you start doing that, then what you're doing is conveying things to the players or to the readers that may just be baggage you don't want to pack.
I can't remember the name of the literary convention right now, but there is a whole convention of giving your characters names that imply what they do or what their role in the story is. Like, if the guy who sells leather goods in your town is named Tanner.
Yeah, I do remember that, but I can't remember what the thing
is. It is an actual word for it, but because I don't have an English degree, I didn't memorize it.
Yeah,
I
mean, so we're like, hey, this is Jimmy Doomed character.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
I'm ready
oh, chapter three, he died! Oh no!
I mean, it's... Go in knowing that it does broadcast something to your PCs, and sometimes you want that. I mean, it's...
Sometimes you can screw with them when you do that. You can name them after a character. You can have Lieutenant Donner, and they're like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to be a real winner. And, you know, maybe he's the exact opposite. Maybe he is the most selfless paladin on the entire town watch. Who knows?
Is he a vegetarian?
Maybe he's a vegetarian. Probably.
I think it can be a lot of fun. It can be a fun wink to your players, especially in, like, home games where you know your players really well. Yeah. In published adventures, or if you're writing for people you don't know, it can be more tricky, especially since you don't know if everyone has the same references as you. When we worked on Siege of Dragonspear, there was an NPC named Herod in the outline. And I was like, should we really call this guy Herod? That seems a little weighted.
Yeah.
And my boss was like, oh yeah, that's like the guy from the Bible. And I'm like, and I said, what is he? Oh yeah, I was thinking he was the boss from Scarlet Armory in Warcraft. Blades of Light! So it depends on what references people are going to get. So.
And even for publication purposes, we usually think of those even more as Easter eggs, which can get the publisher in a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah. We would not publish something like that, but if you're at home and that's something that you want to mess with.
Yeah. I mean, if you want, it's a lot easier to get away with in publishing if you're using, like, a town name or an adjective or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, if the villain's sycophantic assistant is named Mr. Sequius, then...
Don't do that.
I thought it was clever.
Do you have any other...
Can you go back to lifting for inspiration and appropriating? And the example I'm going to bring up is, if you wanted a game in the world of the Last Kingdom, so it's just historical fiction, and it's Alfred the Great and Arthur, and you want to keep that history to shortcut your players, and here's what's going on. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, where does that line go where it's all right to put out a set of historical fiction novels about it, but it starts to cross over when you're doing a gaming plot.
I mean, when we get into appropriation, it's really an issue of what culture you're producing it for, and how the culture you're representing is treated or favored or disfavored in that culture. Like, as a person of Scottish descent, writing about, like, writing a historical fantasy novel set in Scotland, I mean, that's perfectly natural. Me writing it set in medieval England or medieval France or, like, the general area that my ancestors may not be from, but we still have more of a cultural context for, and we in America don't really denigrate that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's less of a concern. But when you're taking inspiration from groups that often don't get to speak for themselves, or that have had their history kind of erased or slandered or rewritten, then it's more tenuous.
I mean, we could have a weekend-long panel on cultural appropriation, and everyone would come up with a slightly different idea, I think. My rule of thumb is I ask myself, who am I going to hurt with this? If... are there Arthurian knights riding around who are going to feel sad about it? No. I mean, I would feel comfortable trying to do some kind of Arthurian fiction. Are there actual African people walking around who might be offended by my portrayal of an African culture? Probably pretty likely, so I should tread more carefully.
Yeah. In that case, be more respectful to the source material, and if at all possible, I cannot say enough how often this has saved me. Find a good sensitivity reader.
Yeah.
If you want to publish and you want to pull from non-Western civilizations, and I think you should, because there are a lot of great things in history that we don't really learn about, like in European/American history, then find somebody who's got some investment in that culture and see if you can get them to basically do an editing pass for you.
And I also feel like if my defense for writing something from another culture is that it doesn't make a difference because all my players are the same race as me and I don't know anyone of another race who would ever read this, then I might have another problem being more than just appropriating. It's fine. All my players are white, and I don't know any non-white people, so I won't get up there.
Yeah, I think anytime you're writing... That's
probably a bad sign.
Probably, yeah. Maybe think about that, right?
Yeah, maybe think about that.
I think anytime you're writing outside of your own experience, particularly keeping in mind the equilibrium of power in our current Western culture, it's very important to keep in mind, like Amber was saying, who am I hurting with this? Mm-hmm. How, in keeping in mind the optics of everything, you know, how am I showing my only non-white race? You know, am I showing them as the villains? Am I portraying them in a stereotypical way? Is there something in this that is in any way, you know, offensive to a group of people, to a class of people, to any sort of identity or anything like that? And just keeping in mind your own privilege is very important as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm a white person. If I'm writing about a Middle Eastern culture, I don't know anything about Middle Eastern cultures from a personal experience standpoint. Yeah. I'm going to screw something up. And so that's why it's important to involve folks who have more of that first-person experience in that, particularly when it's for publication or when it's for a pitch or something like that.
And, because the hour should see that wrapping up.
Okay. Oh, cool.
About 5 till.
I
was going to say that also the more you read, sometimes it allows you to do things or gives you a way to talk back to the people who say you can't do, you can't have this kind of character, you can't have this kind of thing. There was an African-American samurai. A Christian missionary brought him over from Mozambique.
You mean the historical accuracy?
Yeah, a Christian missionary brought this guy from Mozambique to Japan. He ended up staying. He became a samurai. And so when you have the player at your table who says, you know, African Americans can't be samurais, you can say, yeah, actually, you know,
people
you can
be
anything
Timeless,
you want.
That Timeless TV show where they would go back in time to save things, where they go and find the guy who was the inspiration for the Lone Ranger. Did you guys see that?
Oh, right.
Yeah,
I'm so bad with names.
I can't remember either, but he was African-American, and the character Rufus is going, the Lone Ranger is black? Awesome!
Alright, so, we need to clear out so that we can make room for the next panel. Yeah, but
there's another question back here.
We will be here all weekend, and we will probably be able to meet out with you lobby-wise, but we need to make sure that the next group does have time with their
panel. The next panel we are both in.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.